Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or simply hoping to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. All week we've been talking about depression. That's not the proper English for it, though. All week we've been talking. We have talked about depression all week long, and today we're going to talk about the treatment or different ideas for treatments for depression.
What to do about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So we started out the week talking about the complexity of depression. That is, it's more than just sadness. It's not just feeling down and that kind of thing that most of us experience at some point in our life.
Right.
Rather, depression can be a debilitating, complex condition that looks different at different ages. We talked about biological roots. We talked about environmental roots. We talked about some other maybe unusual things that could cause depressive symptoms. Right. And again, today we're going to talk about how to manage depressive symptoms.
That's right. Because any discussion about treatment has to begin with, this is a complex disorder.
Right.
We don't know exactly what causes it. We know there are many causes. There's no single cause. There are many causes. And if you are wedded to a single cause, you're going to get it wrong many, many times.
Right.
Because different people experience depression, the symptoms of depression, for different reasons.
Right.
And you have to get that right in order to get the right treatment.
Right.
And that's why, you know, frequently people will come in and they'll say, well, I've tried a couple of antidepressants and they didn't work. That's, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
They may not work.
Right.
Because you may not be taking the right one for the kind of depression you have.
Right.
Or people will say, well, I've done therapy or I've done this or I've done CBT, but it didn't work. It may not work because that's not the kind of depression you have.
Right.
So any discussion about treatment has to begin with, this is a complex disorder with many, many different causes.
Right.
And what works for one person may not work for another person.
Right. And as we kind of enter into this sort of these types of podcast groupings that we're going to do next week, I think we're going to talk about autism.
Right.
I think that's going to be a recurring theme. You know, we tend to think of these disorders as
monolithic and singular.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, like it's, oh, it's ADHD. So
right.
Or it's depression.
That's right. And ADHD is the same thing. You know, and you mentioned autism. There's a spectrum.
Right.
You know, from mild to severe.
Right.
Symptom presentation.
Right.
Same with depression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So every condition that we will talk about or that could possibly be talked about is very complex.
Right.
And it's more than just those maybe stereotypical symptoms that we tend to associate with those disorders or conditions. And so that will be a recurring theme that we
That's visit. Right. And the other thing is, and I want to go back to autism spectrum disorder, not only are these disorders on a spectrum, but they are of different types.
Right.
So you have strands of autism, you have strands of depression, you have strands of ADHD.
Right.
And it's not a singular diagnosis. ADHD takes many forms. Depression takes many forms. Autism takes many forms.
Right.
And each form is mild to severe.
Right.
So remember, it's not just a single diagnosis, mild to severe. It's multiple diagnoses within a diagnosis. And each one is mild to severe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot that will go into all of these conditions that we talk about over time, and it's just important to think about that. You know, if you're struggling with mood related symptoms, or you have a child with symptoms that look like ADHD, it's not as clear cut, black white, yes no, as many people try to think of them to be. So.
Yep.
So with all of that said, we're going to talk about treatment today. Now, in the show notes, you're going to find the link to three different articles, just because there's a variety of resources that you can find to talk about or to learn about treatments for depression. We're going to pull mostly from one from Psych Central, from an article from Psych Central on the treatment of depression. And we'll talk about a couple of different sort of categories of treatment
right.
that we'll kind of go through.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Very good.
Ready to start with that one?
I'm ready.
All right. So the first group of or type of treatment that we'll talk about is psychotherapy.
Okay.
Now, there's an important reason that we're starting with psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because psychotherapy is and should be the first line of treatment for depression.
Right.
One of the things that really has been in the literature for a long time, but is not necessarily followed as closely as it should be followed, mm-hmm. is the recommendation that, or the findings that most people, and I'm going to use the word most because that's important, most people with depression, their depressive symptoms resolve on their own after a couple of months. Now, again, we talked about that spectrum. And there's only there's a relative minority of patients who are in this severe end of depression that stay in the severe end of depression. Most people who experience depressive symptoms do so in response to something that's happened in their lives, as right. a response to something that's going on in their life at the time, and those depressive symptoms come, and then as those issues in their life resolve, those depressive symptoms, you know, go away.
No, you're absolutely right, and I think we should state that boldly and with a certain amount of, with more than a little confidence,
mm-hmm.
that there are two broad classes of treatments. There are medications,
right.
and there are a list of non-medical right. interventions. But you're right, for most people, these symptoms are going to go away on their own.
Right.
Because you're reacting to something. Remember, we have to look at your biology, your mm-hmm. environment, and your temperament.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us are reacting to some environmental event.
Right.
Death, loss, grief, geographic relocation, right. change in financial circumstances, having your cars vandalized.
That's a close to home here.
You know, things like that happen, and they knock you into a little bit of mm-hmm. depression. But you're absolutely right. In most cases, you're going to come out of that. So mm-hmm. don't rush to medication,
right.
because they're going to resolve on their own.
Right.
And you may have several bouts of depression throughout your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you need to worry too much about.
Right.
Now, if it persists, and what would you say to people if it persists beyond a couple of months,
four months. Or if you're not able to go to work
because
if it's interfering with your functioning, then you go ahead and go get help.
But right. If it's severe depression, if it's debilitating, if it's preventing you from leaving the house, getting
right.
out of bed, doing something, then you may want to go right to medication.
Or at least go to start talking to someone.
To get to somebody
because,
who does know.
You know, right. that's important. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an emerging trend over the past decade or so. At least over the past decade, and it's not followed in all trials. But mm-hmm. you know, when they're looking at medications for depression,
right.
one of the things, you know, we always talk about the treatment group and the medication group and the placebo group. You
right.
know, we have a double blind placebo controlled studies.
Mm-hmm.
So one group gets the medication and the other group gets a placebo. So they think they're getting the medication, but they're not sure. Many times now with depression studies, they're adding a third group, mm-hmm. and that third group is just called the waitlist group.
Right.
And that's a group of patients with depression who are on the list to be mm-hmm. in the study,
right.
but you know, they're monitored over, you know, a number of weeks before they are enrolled in the study to see how their symptoms do.
That's right.
Without any treatment at all.
That's
without
enough.
Even thinking that they're getting a placebo yeah. or thinking that they're getting a medication.
What we call a no treatment group.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what we find is that those people get better too.
Which is different from a placebo group, because
right.
the placebo group thinks it's being treated.
Right.
The people in that group aren't sure. So the assumption is I'm being treated.
Right.
Okay. May or may not be, but the assumption is I am. The no treatment group is not being treated.
And they know they're not being treated.
Right. right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really important that we remember that, because there is a large group of people with depression who just mm-hmm. who they just get better with time.
Right.
Now, sometimes that
sucks. That time period is bad because it's depression. I mean, you know, nobody likes to be depressed, so it's difficult. And again, this is where, you know, psychotherapy certainly comes into play. Mm-hmm. But so again, kind of going back to the beginning then, the first line of treatment for depression should be psychotherapy, because then you're working on strategies for, you know, managing and working through some of those symptoms.
That's right. And the first step may be, let's do nothing for a while. I mean, if you go to, I mean, you may decide on your own, let's just ride this out. It's not that bad. I mean, I'd like to feel a little bit better, but I can manage this on my own. Right. Or I have a self-help book or a self-help app or a self-help program. And you can do that and you kind of pull yourself out of it. Okay. So that's the first thing. Or you may go to a professional, and you and the professional may decide, let's just ride this out. You know, it's not that bad. You're not severely affected by it. So let's not do anything for a while. Let's see how it goes.
Right.
Because you can always begin psychotherapy. And what I tell my patients is, look, we can always use medication, but let's try these things first. Right. If they don't work, then we go to medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah, I was just telling a patient yesterday that, you know, his depression bothered him, but it wasn't stopping him from going to school. Right. It wasn't stopping him from doing some of the things he needed to do. Mm-hmm. And we were able to quickly recognize things in his life that he does, just doesn't do enough of, that help make his depression feel better. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, very direct, you know, psychotherapy, got to put that a little bit in quotations because it's more psychoeducation,
right?
Just to say, hey, you know how you feel really good after you go exercise? Why don't you go exercise a little bit more often than just once or twice a week?
Right. And one of the articles that you posted with this podcast was 10 of what are called natural remedies.
Right.
And they are things like diet and exercise and sleep and, you know, relationships and those sorts of things that you can do. There's a whole list of things. I think there are 10 in that article.
Yeah.
10 things that you can do to bring relief that you may not need medication. You may not even need psychotherapy.
Right.
It may just be that you need to redo your exercise program or change the way you eat or change the way you sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. So now when it comes to therapy, psychotherapy, the most common, commonly utilized strategy or approach to therapy, psychotherapy for depression, is cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's for a couple of reasons. Cognitive behavioral therapy. So the focus is on cognitions and behavior. Cognitions because, you know, one of the key aspects of key non-diagnostic aspects of depression is I was gonna say abnormal, but that, you know, that doesn't help. It's problematic thinking, basically.
Irrational thinking.
Irrational. That's a good word.
Right.
You know, the nevers, the always, the sort of definitives that we use.
Right.
I will never get any better. I always make mistakes. You know, no one likes me. Those kinds of irrational,
absolutist, you know, where you say I'm never this, or I'm ugly, or I'm incompetent, or I'm gonna fail, I'm a failure at everything.
They're absolute, they're global, and so it's, you know, you fail a test at school, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm a horrible student. You know, I'm never going to graduate. You know, it's, well, that was just one test. You know, it's it's fine, but it becomes very generalized, very global, and absolute.
So the
cognitive aspect of cognitive behavioral therapy works to attack those those thoughts, and try to, and we call them, I like to refer to them as cognitive distortions. They're just distorting reality to, because of the depression.
And the idea with cognitive behavioral therapy, because it focuses on thinking and behavior, you step back from the emotion. Forget about the emotion for a minute, because you really aren't able to do anything about that. But you can change how you think, and you can change how you behave. When we talk about going to the gym, that's a behavioral change. We talk about working out, changing your sleep, changing your eating patterns, changing relationships. Those are all behaviors. So change those behaviors and you change the emotions. Change your thinking and you change your emotions. So that's the idea behind cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's shown to be very effective with individuals who struggle with these symptoms.
And that behavioral piece, as you said, you know, could include, you know, increasing the amount of time you exercise. It could include, you know, going out and interacting with other people. The key there is a very direct behavioral approach to combat some of the things that depression wants you to do.
Right.
You know, we talked about this on a previous podcast, but depression makes you want to seclude yourself, to stay in bed, to stay away from other people, to not interact. You don't feel as though you have the energy or the motivation or the drive to do some of these things. So the behavioral treatment for that is exactly the opposite of that. You know, get out, go do something, interact with other people. It is difficult. It is hard to do, but you have to get yourself to do it for some prescribed time on a daily basis.
I was just smiling because I was thinking in those days when we said the devil made me do it, you know, I did, the devil's working in my life. At least you had something to battle against when you said the devil. Now it's like, well, I have this brain chemistry and I can't do anything about it. So, but if it's the devil, you can fight against that. It gives you an object to direct
a focus,
your intervention at or to.
Well, and I mean, that's a great point, because what it does is it puts the focus outside of you.
That's right.
It's not me. It's the devil making me do it, so I can battle him. And if it's me, then I have to battle myself. And how do you do that?
How do you battle your brain?
Yeah.
You know, but the devil, that's an object that I can conceptualize.
Yeah.
So interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, but
that's a good point.
Some advantage.
Yeah. So cognitive behavioral therapy, again, is one of the main treatment approaches for that, and that's how it works, is to address the thoughts, the cognitions, as well as some of the behavioral things to do both at the same time.
And frequently people come in and say, oh, I've tried that. I can't just change the way I think.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't.
Right.
But you can change the way you behave.
Right.
You can make
specific decisions.
Right. There's also a behavioral component to this. So you may not be good at changing your thinking, but you might be very good at changing your behavior.
Right.
So let's try both.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And work on, you know, if the behavioral part is easier first, focus on the behavioral part while you're working on the...
For me, the behavioral part was always much easier and much more effective. It was easier for me to change my behaviors than to change my thinking.
Right.
You know? So make sure you're considering both,
and
not just changing your thinking.
Yeah. Because, and the approach that we would take with the cognitive part is just, you know, when you have those absolute generalized, you know, negative thoughts, you combat them with reality. You know, I never do well. I always fail my tests. Well, what's your GPA? Well, it's a 3.8. But clearly, if it's a 3.8, you're not failing. You're not doing poorly on every test. But it's the way that our thoughts take over sometimes.
I was talking to a young woman recently. I think she's about 19, some kind of college student. And
some kind of college student.
I mean, she was like freshman, sophomore, about age 19 or 20. And she came in and she said, I'm never going to get married. I'm going to be single the rest. That's why I'm laughing. I'm going to be single the rest of my life. And I thought, okay, let's consider that. Well, to make a long story short, that's distorted thinking.
Right.
Okay. And she had everything else going for her.
Right.
Successful student. She had friends. She has a supportive family. She works part-time. I mean, her whole life is completely organized. And when I walked her through this, by the end of the conversation, she was sort of smiling, because, you know, what is a guy gonna add to your life? If you get a boyfriend right now, that's what she wanted. I want a boyfriend. I said, well, do your girlfriends have boyfriends? No. What is he going to bring to your life? And she started to smile.
Yeah.
He brings very little to
her.
I mean, she has a full, rich life, but she was thinking about this one missing piece.
Right.
And it became catastrophic.
Right.
But as we talked through it, she began to change her thinking a little bit.
About,
well, maybe I don't need to have a boyfriend right now.
Yeah.
But that's what you're talking about when you get hold of one of these things and it just becomes bigger than it really should be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But she was laughing. She was funny because she had this realization as we were talking, and it was fun to watch.
Yeah. Now, there are other therapeutic strategies and approaches.
Right.
You know, again, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is the most common, but you also have rational emotive therapy. You have behavioral therapy, interpersonal.
Sometimes, I like the interpersonal one.
Yeah.
You know, just work on your relationships.
Right.
Very easy to do.
Yeah.
Free. Either get new relationships or redo the relationships you have.
Right.
We were listening to a podcast the other day about marriage.
Yeah.
You know, the one you emailed me that podcast. And so many people are unhappy in their marriages, you know. So work on making your marriage better.
Right.
You know, that might make you feel much better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
or your relationship with your children.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, a second form of treatment. So we have psychotherapy.
Right.
Okay. Now, the second form of therapy that it talks about in this Psych Central article is hospitalization. And of course, this is for very severe cases.
Right.
And I would, you know, I don't know the percentage. I don't know that anybody knows the percentage, but it's a very small percentage of people with depression that would need hospitalization.
Mm-hmm. And they really fall into two categories.
Mm-hmm.
One, of course, is any suicide risk,
right. You
know, self-harm or suicide.
Right.
The other is depression that is so debilitating that you simply have lost your ability to function.
Right.
That would be a second group that might need a short stay, days to weeks in a hospital setting.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, so.
But what's the purpose of hospitalization? Just to stabilize you enough so you can get out and do the other treatments that you need.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So. And many times when you're in the hospital, that's when they would start medication.
Exactly.
So that's how it kind of transitions to that third area of treatment, which is medication.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So the medications for depression are interesting. They're interesting things. Because it's, you know, we've talked about this in a previous podcast, but it just, anytime I think about it, it just amazes me how we discover things in psychiatry and just we kind of latch onto it and we just hold on to it. And because, you know, the medicinal treatment for depression was found accidentally in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were, what was it, antihistamine? Or I think it was an antihistamine that they were giving patients that were, you know, in the hospital. They were giving them antihistamine because they were experiencing allergies and things that they needed the antihistamine for.
Right.
And they, you know, some of the depressive symptoms are improved.
I think it's
antihistamines. And then, let's look at what this medication is. And then, it's a tricyclic or something that we're going to call a tricyclic antidepressant.
Right.
And so then all of a sudden we develop a whole bunch of those. And then from there we develop from the tricyclics. Then we have monoamine oxidase inhibitors, MAOIs, and those presented with a lot of problems for people, especially Americans, because of our American diet.
All the chocolate.
You can't have, there's certain micronutrients that you have to cut out of your diet if you're taking MAOIs, and so you certainly can't take a lot of other medications if you're on MAOIs. And then we get the SSRIs that evolved after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we have these sort of, in one of the books that I use for teaching psychopharmacology, it just calls them heterocyclics. And so, because it covers a bunch of, or several different neurotransmitters as opposed to just serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
SSRIs are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So, but it's just
how many different SSRIs are there?
There's
about eight. So you have
maybe more than that.
You have the original tricyclic antidepressants, the early ones.
Right.
Okay. Then you have the SSRIs,
more
recent, starting with Prozac. There are a number of those. And now you can also use atypical antipsychotics, like Abilify now is one you can add, or monoamine oxidase inhibitors. So we're already talking about a large class of drugs, SSRIs, plus three or four other groups of drugs, because not everybody responds to the same thing. We have all these medications because not everybody responds to the same thing. So we always return to the same theme.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complex disorder.
Yeah.
What works for one may not work for another.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But there's a range of medications here, and you just have to try them until you find the one that works for you.
Right, right. And as you said, there's several different SSRIs.
Mm-hmm.
So all of them work to increase serotonin,
right.
Mm-hmm. If we said it very generally. But they all work on a different subtype,
right,
of serotonin, which is why for some people, Prozac may not be very effective, but Zoloft may be very effective,
right.
Because mm-hmm. it works on a slightly different system.
Okay.
So, you know, you do, you know, there are ways that physicians can guesstimate,
right,
or hypothesize which mm-hmm. one may be more effective for, right, a person than another. So if it's a, you know, if you have a parent or have a relative that found mm-hmm. success with one medication, right, the physician is most likely going to try to start with that one,
mm-hmm.
because based upon your biology and the relative similarity with somebody that's related to you, mm-hmm. you may benefit from that one as well.
Exactly.
But otherwise, it's, you know, we try one and see how it goes, and if it mm-hmm. doesn't work, then we try a different one.
That's right. But it's not a precise science,
right,
yet. You can't say, well, here, your blood test shows this, so we're going to give you the,
right,
third medication on the list.
Right.
It's not that precise yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately. As is the case with all medications, you know, there are some complications and problems,
yeah,
with medications for depression. The first is that, and this is so important, and I can't tell you how many times, you know, I have to talk with patients about this. These medications take a while to get into your system,
right,
and start working.
That's the biggest frustration.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you have ADHD and you get on a stimulant, right, medication, you start experiencing the benefits within 30
mm-hmm.
minutes of taking,
right,
it,
mm-hmm.
and those benefits wear off, you know, relatively quickly within
the same day,
know, 10
certainly.
To 12 hours,
right,
and
mm-hmm.
and then you're back to,
right,
where you were. Antidepressants don't work that way, and, well, there's a couple of things with that, but oftentimes they take at least 2 weeks, sometimes up to 6 weeks,
right,
before you start seeing any benefit.
In most of the literature, they say 6 to 8 weeks, just to let
mm-hmm.
you know that this is, you have to be patient.
Right.
Right.
And you know, so if we think about how that process works,
mm-hmm.
you know, a physician may, will start a person on the lowest dose, you know, the starter
mm-hmm.
dose. You have to be on that for a little while before you,
right,
start even in expecting to see any benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if after, you know, 4 weeks, say, there's no benefit, you may not be completely sure if it's because it's just too low of a dose,
right,
or if it's because that medication is not going to work, and so then you may want to increase that dose, and so
increase
the physician
the
will
first,
increase,
right,
the dose and see how you respond to that over the next,
right,
week or two. And so, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this is a multi-month process of finding the right medication,
which again is the most telling argument for trying other things first. Get things started,
right,
do all these other things, because the medications could take weeks or months,
right,
to find the medication that works best for you.
Right, because,
so,
again, by the time you would find a medication that's beneficial,
mm-hmm.
you don't know if it's beneficial or if it's just the depression has run,
right,
its course.
Right.
And so now,
right,
you're on medication that you don't really need to be on,
mm-hmm.
and that's,
yeah,
a complication.
Right.
The other interesting argument,
mm-hmm.
I guess argument against medications that I've seen is the argument that sort of the counterintuitive nature of the fact that, you know, when you take an SSRI, for example, what it does is it blocks these reuptake receptor sites so that your neurons continuously release serotonin. And it does that, you know, as soon as you
mm-hmm.
take it, you know, not as soon as you take it, but after a short time after taking it. And so people, you know, argue that, you know, there should be some benefit right away. If these medications are really what's happening,
right,
really what's going on, you should see something
mm-hmm.
right away. And because we don't, you know, that's an argument that some people have against the use of medications in general, because,
right,
it just doesn't make sense that you wouldn't see a benefit if
mm-hmm.
you know, if serotonin really was the problem, and here you are taking something that's going to increase your serotonin levels, you should be seeing a improvement right away. Pharmaceutical companies and many doctors will talk about the idea of upregulation
mm-hmm.
and downregulation and some of those kinds of things, but it is a compelling argument. Whether it holds water or not, you know,
mm-hmm.
who knows. But there's that issue.
Right.
Another big issue with medication is the fact that some research has come out recently to suggest that old research that really supported the use of medication maybe wasn't as honest and comprehensive as we once thought.
Right.
Is that a safe way to say it?
Safe way to say, yeah, as safe as we can be.
Yeah.
Yeah, the studies had questionable results. Now that right. we reanalyze all those right. data, we come up with some different conclusions.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that for some of these medications, they may not be quite as effective as they that's were right. once purported to be.
That's right.
And that's a really important point because, you know, we were talking earlier about psychotherapy and sometimes, you know, self-help lifestyle-like things like exercise right. and meditation. And, you know, some research is coming out to suggest that meditation may be more beneficial, as beneficial, if not more beneficial, than medication.
That's right.
For some of these cases.
I think the biggest thing is subject or participant selection,
right.
you know, and that may be that the newer studies are more selecting their participants differently with mm-hmm. more precision.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be careful about that we don't overinterpret right. the efficacy of these things. But again, it's exactly to the point that you're speaking to. Let's not over rely on medication mm-hmm. Because there are many other things you can do.
Right.
Okay. So the medication is an imprecise science.
Right.
There's no guarantee. I mean, you hear stories about, oh, I started, once I took Wellbutrin, I was fine. So ask your doctor for Wellbutrin. Or mm-hmm. you get a commercial, TV mm-hmm. commercial, yeah. ask your doctor for. Well, it may or may not work for you. Okay.
Yeah.
But there are many, many things you can do while you're waiting for the medications to work.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, one last issue with medication is the issue that I think most people have with medications in general, and that is the side effects.
Side effects, right.
You know, there are some expected side effects mm-hmm. of antidepressant medications, one of which is decreased libido.
Right.
But you also get, you know, some difficulties with some changes, interference with sleep,
mm-hmm.
Either making it to where you're very tired.
Right.
Or making it a little bit more difficult to sleep.
Exactly.
What some people will say is that it does improve the depression, but it will make people feel numb.
Right.
Is something that a lot of patients complain about.
That's right. That you're not sad, but you don't get real happy.
Right.
It sort of levels out the peaks mm-hmm. and the valleys that, no, I'm no longer sad, but now I'm not happy either.
Right.
Okay, because it kind of dulls everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most concerning side effect is some of the research is suggesting, I'm trying to say it carefully.
Carefully,
some
again.
Because I have strong opinions about this. Some of the research is suggesting the risk for increased suicidal ideation in
especially
children,
in teenagers,
and maybe right. even young adults mm-hmm. on antidepressant medications.
I didn't know whether to mention that during this or not. That may be, I'm thinking that we should do a separate podcast
mm-hmm.
on that topic.
Right.
Because we continue to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a case a week or so ago, and one of the teachers in the school that this boy attended said, well, if we put him on Prozac, we increase his suicide risk. And I
mm-hmm.
thought, I didn't
yeah.
want to have an argument or discussion about it at
mm-hmm.
that time, but I'm thinking maybe that's an issue that we ought to revisit
yeah.
and devote a whole podcast to it.
That'd be a good idea.
I remember when those black box warnings first came out, there was a rash of, or seemed to be a rash of suicides, and we talked to the psychiatrists about it. And they gave us very good advice, but
yeah.
that may be a separate
yeah.
talk. It's
yeah.
an important issue.
Yeah, because people have looked mm-hmm. at those reports and looked at that data pretty closely
right.
and said it may have been a bit of an overreaction.
Right.
And, you know, I have some diagnostic questions about things and
well,
that kind of stuff. So
yes.
it may be good for
it may not be a simple case of depression that was
right.
being treated.
Yeah.
Okay. So It's a little more complicated. Yeah, That's not a simple one.
Yeah, that'll take a little bit of explaining. Right. Some splaining to do.
Explain it to me, Lucy.
All right. So again, you know, Medicaid for those for whom medication is beneficial,
right,
makes a big difference.
Right.
People. You know, I certainly have patients who are on antidepressant medications who say there is no way that I'm going to stop because the difference between off the medication and on the medication is so profound. Right. There's no way that they're going to stop. Mm-hmm. And I think that the relative benefits of medication, you know, where some people respond very, very well and some people don't respond, some people just don't respond at all to medication, it kind of gets back to that, you know, what was it, Wednesday discussion that we had about the biological bases of depression. Okay. That, you know, we think about it sort of, you know, superficially as a chemical imbalance.
You don't have enough serotonin in your system.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if it was just that, Prozac should work for everybody.
Everybody would get better on any SSRI.
Right. Okay. And because we just know that it's not.
Right. Because that doesn't work. It suggests a more complex problem.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So. Now,
so we've done what? We've done all the psychotherapies, and we've done
hospitalization.
The medications and hospitalization.
Right.
Okay.
Now, the last area that we'll talk about is some newer technology and older technology.
New wine in old casks.
Yeah. And that is electroconvulsive therapy,
right.
ECT.
Right.
All right. Don't go to YouTube or on Google or anything and look for videos of it, because 99 times out of 100, what you're going to find are old videos of people doing shock therapy back in the day when it was very rudimentary, very crude,
and
somewhat potentially effective for some people,
right?
But not, certainly not what's happening today,
right?
So they don't even call it shock therapy. I don't even know that they ever really call it shock therapy. But,
I mean, it got a very bad reputation in TV and movies,
right?
You know, where we see these gruesome,
these big suction cups on the side of people's heads, and
put a thing in their mouth, and you know, all that stuff. That may have been the way it was done previously. Mm-hmm. And what you're actually doing is you're inducing a seizure,
right?
With the old way of doing it.
Yeah.
And so your knee, what it does is it sort of wakes up your neurons and makes them realign a little bit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But today's ECT is very different from the ECT that you're used to seeing in movies and TV.
Now, the use of ECT really is sort of last resort.
It's a last resort
type of thing. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about a different type of brain stimulation treatment in just a moment. But ECT itself is usually a treatment of last resort. Mm-hmm. Usually it's started during hospitalization for people with non-responsive severe depression or bipolar disorder, severe mood-related disorders. Mm-hmm. And basically what happens, and you know, honest, I have seen people with, and I mentioned this earlier this week, I've seen people with almost catatonic depression, severe depression, have an ECT treatment.
A single
ECT treatment.
Exactly.
Go to bed, because they'll sleep the rest of the day.
Sleep. Right.
The next day when I saw them, my next shift, completely different person.
Yeah, it's a last resort, and it's reserved for very severe symptoms.
Right.
But when it works, it is miraculous.
Right. Right. And as we were kind of saying before, if you do, you know, look up any of those videos, you're going to find very old school, raw types of treatments. Mm-hmm. Today it's very, very different. The electricity, the electrical currents are applied to very specific areas, regions of the brain, is not globalized like it used to be.
Right.
They're applied to very specific regions. The person mm-hmm. is usually sedated, and so the person mm-hmm. doesn't really feel anything, just like any other medical treatment when you're unconscious. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, they sleep for the rest of the day, and then they tend to recover very well the next
mm-hmm.
day.
Right.
You know, this comes from, well, it's been around for a long time, so it doesn't really come from some of these recent studies, but in the late 90s, mm-hmm. 98, 99, and then since then, there have been, in 99, I think we found that was when the first article of this sort was published, and there's been a number of articles, reports since then, of people who have been, who have undergone like deep brain stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, you know, maybe they had severe Parkinson's or some other condition, and they had, you know, a device implanted mm-hmm. To stimulate regions of their brain to relieve Parkinsonian symptoms. So they stopped their shaking and all that kind of stuff. There have been many different reports from different locations of people who undergo deep brain stimulation for their Parkinson's symptoms, who, if those electrodes are misplaced
mm-hmm.
by not very far,
not very small distances,
mm-hmm. you affect people's mood.
Right.
You know, the first report from 99 was, the one that I read was a woman who had absolutely no history of mood-related mm-hmm. disorders or issues or anything like that. As soon as the as soon as her brain was stimulated,
mm-hmm.
She went into a suicidal depression.
Right.
Completely surprised the neurologists. Mm-hmm. They had no idea what was happening.
Right.
Because there hadn't been reports of that before. And then, you know, they turn the stimulation off, and she kind of rebounds into somewhat of a hypomanic phase before returning back to normal. And all of this happens within mm-hmm. a few minutes.
Right.
And so we know that there is a relationship between stimulation in the brain in different regions and mood.
That's right. You can stimulate the brain externally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can put something on the outside of your scalp and send those what are essentially sound waves or mm-hmm. some kind of usually sound waves, and they will activate neurons in certain
mm-hmm.
areas.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, if you activate them in the left front part of your brain, you're going to affect somebody's mood.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So it's fascinating. But we know that it is effective. We know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that we necessarily know, just like with the medications, exactly what happens.
Exactly why.
But it can be a very effective strategy for people with severe non-responsive depression.
Right. You're talking about hundreds of millions of neurons being affected. So it's really hard to say exactly what's going on. It's just a complexity
mm-hmm.
that we don't completely understand yet.
Right.
But ECT, today's ECT, though it is not without risk,
mm-hmm.
it's a last resort, but it's very effective and very different from what you've seen on TV.
Right.
Question, this TM, transcranial magnetic stimulation, has that been approved by insurance companies yet? I don't think it has been.
I don't know if it's been approved. I don't think it has been either, unless it's been within the last...
Because it's hard to... It's expensive to do any of these treatments.
Right.
And I think ECT is covered. I'm not sure that TMS...
Well, so TMS, or RTMS, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, is just as it sounds. You're transcranial means so it's on the outside,
mm-hmm.
And you're stimulating through the use of magnetic currents. And unlike ECT, TMS is done outpatient.
Right.
You know, you can go to your mm-hmm. outpatient psychiatrist mm-hmm. and receive.
Sit in a comfortable chair and have electromagnetic pulses coming mm-hmm. into your brain.
And it is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we know of a friend of ours who used to do TMS here in town in our area, but stopped because it was so expensive.
Right.
And it just wasn't sustainable. When I worked at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of South mm-hmm. Florida, one of the psychiatrists there did it, and had a little machine in his outpatient office.
Okay.
And again, I'm not I don't know enough about how he did it to know if that insurance covered it, or if he just, you know, if it was part of anything else
could
that he
have
was
been
doing.
A study or something.
Yeah. So, but again, for people who do it, can be very effective, very beneficial. Right. We have here in our office a Fisher Wallace is a company that makes a very low current, slight, basically transcranial stimulator.
Right.
You have these sponges, you put them on the side of your head, and it holds on there. Mm-hmm. And you know, they have some pretty impressive data to suggest that, you know, doing it 20 minutes a day improves mood.
I think that's the next direction we're going to move in,
is
transcranial stimulation or neurofeedback or other ways of affecting the brain more directly.
Right.
But again, I don't want to say avoid medication, because medication helps large numbers of people. But if we can do things without medication, then we don't have to worry about side effects.
Right. Yeah. So those are the
much to think about.
Yeah. Those are some other treatment approaches.
I think the brain stimulation has the most hope. I mean, at least from the ones that I've seen.
Right.
Has the most hope for future efficacy.
Well, again, it goes back to what we talked about before with, you know, with sort of biofeedback and neurofeedback and things like that. You're working with the brain directly to change the way that it's thinking, the way that you're thinking, the way that it's functioning,
the way that it's working right now.
Right. So psychotherapy, hospitalization, last resort. If you're in the hospital, sometimes, you know, if it's real severe and unresponsive, you'll have, you know, ECT is there. And then, of course, medication. So lots of different treatment approaches for depression. We have those three articles posted in the show notes. So if you want to check those out, you can read some different things.
Because three different perspectives.
You know, we didn't get into some other in any detail. Anyways, we mentioned them, but the lifestyle things like exercise and diet and sleep and all those things that certainly influence your mood and can affect your depressive symptoms. So, but check those out and, you know, see what you think.
Right.
All right.
Very good.
Well, then that is it for today.
Happy Saturday.
To you as well, sir. Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid. Thanks for sharing this episode of the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you will find all of our previous podcasts and much more. We would be honored if you would become a patron through patreon.com, where any donation you can manage will go to the development and creation of more content. Just visit patreon.com/themental breakdown for more information. Thanks again for listening. Have an awesome day, and we look forward to being back in your feed tomorrow morning.